This is Oral History 1120, the WIS Women's Information Switchboard Project. This is Alison Murchie interviewing Liz Ahern at the State Library on the 25th of September 2017. Thank you, Liz, for agreeing to do this project. And with a resume like yours, it's going to be a real struggle to squeeze it all into an hour, but we will somehow manage. First, could I have your full name, please?
Elizabeth Carolyn Howard Ahern.
And where and when were you born?
I was born in Albury, New South Wales, in 6th of December, 1949.
Now, you have given me the courtesy of an resume, which is handy, but just for the tape, could we do the five-minute potted version of your work career before you got to WIS, and then at the end we might just add on what you've been doing since WIS, because I know you spent a long time in the early days of WIS when the switchboard was not far from where we're sitting at the moment. So perhaps you could just give me a little bit of your background.
I started off as a... I did a university in New South Wales. I did an arts degree. I did teaching because I needed the Teachers College scholarship money to get through university in those days. And I became a teacher at Caringbah High School, where I taught for nearly 3 years. Then I went overseas and I was living in London for a year, and I decided that really teaching was not what I wanted to do. I wanted to be a librarian, so I then worked in a library at a polytechnic, which is a bit between a university and a TAFE in London. And then when I came back to Australia, I then enrolled in the library studies course down the end of North Terrace at the old SAIT building, where I studied under Tony Foscott and whatever, and that's what I was doing in 1977, I think. Yeah, 77 I did that course.
So you became a librarian.
So I turned myself into a librarian.
But and that was the right decision for you?
Oh, yes. But one of the things I did was I also became pregnant that year. So at the end of the year, I finished my library course, and then I had a small baby and no family support, basically, in South Australia. So for quite a while, I stayed home with my baby, I guess, for a couple of years, well, about a year. And then I eventually I was involved with Women's Electoral Lobby because I was going slightly demented, not having any...
And Will would have been at its peak in 77.
Intellectual stimulation. So I became the publicity officer for the Women's Electoral Lobby. And I was membership officer as well. And I worked with some amazing women who were involved with Well in those days. And it was a lot of fun, and we were being very political and jumping up and down, and I got to know the women's movement in South Australia because I had gone to university in Sydney, and we'd come back. When we came back from London, there was a job that we found in South Australia for my husband Michael, and that's how we ended up here. And we thought, oh, we'll come for a year or so, and 42 years later, we're still here.
I found Adelaide does have that effect on people. Yeah. Once we get them here, we like to keep
We
them.
Had been here once for a week's holiday and thought that was a nice town. And we're both country people, so it's a nice blend of country town and city.
It's manageable, isn't it? Yes.
For us, which works for us because we have the advantages of both. Right. So that's really how we ended up being here.
So what happened after Well?
Well, while I was in Well, I was involved with planning a conference on rape, prostitution and pornography. And it was part of the University of Adelaide had a community education program. And I don't know, I wasn't there at the beginning of the program, but I got involved because they wanted someone from Well to do some planning and organising. And they were some of my skills. And so I used to go to these meetings. And it was at one of those meetings, we were discussing how we were formatting this conference, and it was a conference aimed at all the women's organisations in South Australia, which was quite a lot in those days.
Certainly was.
And it included the very conservative women from the Catholic Women's Welfare League, plus the Liberal Party and all the different Labor Party, Women's Liberation, the whole gamut of women's organisations were all involved in this conference. And I said to them, how can we have a conference on prostitution where we don't ask the prostitutes their point of view? We can't have all these middle-class women sitting around discussing prostitution from a tut-tut model. We need to find out what was the reality of the experience of prostitutes. So my baby and I was told Andy Sebastian was the person to talk to, who was the information officer at the women's unit working with Deborah McCulloch in those days. So Andy and I met, and we arranged for me to go around to some brothels and ask some prostitutes if they'd be willing to come to this conference. It was quite an interesting experience because obviously I'd never been to a brothel. I wasn't even quite sure how to find them, but I ended up going to sex shops and saying, where's the nearest brothel? And eventually people would look at me and think, why does this woman want to know where the brothel is anyway?
Is she looking for a job?
They didn't know because I had a baby on my hip. I had my 6-month or 9-month old baby on my hip. And anyway, she and I went off and interviewed women in this and told them about the project and what we were trying to do. And as a result of that, we did manage to have a small group of prostitutes did come to the conference, and we kept them in a very safe space within the conference, so they were able to put their point of view, because it was all, everyone worked in small groups and everyone got opportunities to have their say, but it was really important that the prostitutes got to say what they wanted to say about prostitution. And, you know, we are still, all these years later, unable.
Still got the same battle.
We have still got the same battle, and we have still not managed, although Steph Key has tried over and over again to get that legislation through.
And there's a long history before Steph as well. Yeah. Carolyn Pickles, Anne Levy.
Well, that was all after this conference.
So many.
So that was way back in. This was all as a result of this conference back in 78 that this all happened. That after that was the first bill, and I think Milhouse might have even...
That's right, Robin Milhouse.
I think
he put
the first bill up. And so those... And it was my first experience of knowing anything about pornography too, and that was a bit of an eye-opener for a middle-class girl like me. So that was quite interesting, challenging in a few
ways. This sounds very much as though you're leading up to your position at WIS, isn't it?
Well... Andy, because she was setting up the Women's Information Service at that time, and she said to me, you're just the sort of person we're looking for. You've got library skills, so information organising skills. You're a feminist, you're interested in women's stuff, and would you like to be a volunteer? And yes, I said I would. So I'm an original volunteer, one of the first group that were...
Did you have to think very hard about taking this?
Yeah. And by then, I was pregnant with my second child. She was in utero around, I think it's around June or July, the anniversary. I think that's when we started. I remember it sort of being midwinter. And I used to go off to meetings, and sometimes I'd take my baby with me. And
that really was what WIS was all about too,
yeah,
wasn't it?
Yeah, and so my babies, who are now 40 and 38, were some of WIS's original first babies, because we used to bring our babies to when we were volunteering, and they used to crawl around on the floor and be entertained.
You clearly had some fairly substantial background already from the work that you'd been doing. But did you really have a set brief as to what was expected of you as a volunteer?
Well, there was training available, and we had all sorts of training camps, and we had some hilarious experiences in some of the training camps.
Where were they held?
Oh, they were held at sort of scout camp type places, and it was very funny. I remember Deborah McCulloch was a cook one year for one camp. And a lot of women back in those days were vegetarian. And I don't know whether some of us were more sensitive to beans than others, but I remember that Deborah had prepared this huge bean stew dal type thing, and we were cooking in large numbers because there probably would have been 30 women staying at this camp this particular weekend. And some of us who didn't eat legumes every day really blew up and bloated. And the sound effects were quite spectacular later. And I know that because I was 6 months pregnant, I had real trouble doing up my jeans because I just bloated.
Oh, that is
astronomically
funny.
Astronomically, it was hilarious. And we just teased Deborah for years later about the bean episode.
That's definitely a Deb story that should go down in history,
yeah,
isn't it?
Oh, it was,
so
it was very
funny. So what sort of things did you do those training camps? I mean, obviously a lot of fun.
Yeah, but to have the women's advisor being the cook. Yeah. I mean, she was the most foremost public servant in South Australia in the women's area, and she was the cook for the camp. So it shows you how egalitarian, I guess, the whole process was. And those were the days of collectives and working responsibly in joint. And there was paid staff. There were six paid
staff. How many volunteers were there when you started?
Oh, well, it grew. Yeah. You know, because
I was
one of the first intake, and I can't tell you now, but I still see some of them around town. I saw one of them at a concert yesterday. There was a woman sitting in front of me, who Margaret King, who used to teach German at Adelaide University, and she was sitting in a row in front of me at a classical music concert yesterday. So she and I always catch up and have a little chat.
You're just about to say the paid staff. So who?
The paid staff. Let me think who there was at the beginning. There was. The first coordinator was Ros Johnson. Then there was Pamela Verrill. Lovely red-haired woman. Louisa Sheehan was the Italian worker, and she was also she spoke German fluently as well. Nikki Dimitropoulos was the Greek worker.
Sorry, Nikki?
Nikki Dimitropoulos.
I'll write it as it sounds.
D-I-M-I-T-R-O-P-O-U-L-O-S. Is it Dimitropoulos?
Right, as it sounds, good.
I'm just trying to think who else. Carmel O'Reilly, she was in those days.
I've interviewed
Carmel.
Carmel,
yeah,
yes.
Yeah. Carmel, because
and what was it, Riley?
She was O'Reilly then, but later became.
Right. I'm actually catching up with her next week, I think.
So how many have I said there?
That's quite a few, actually, because you've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 paid staff, which would be...
I think there were six. There's somebody who I'll
another
have
one
to,
will come to you.
I'll have to think who the other person was. Mm. There's one more person, I think, who was there at the beginning. Obviously, over the years,
clearly there were lots of change. Right from the start, was it clear that it was a feminist organisation?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, and all of the women... I remember talking to Carmel. She didn't actually consider herself a feminist when she started.
No, well,
others would have been perhaps in the same view?
Well,
and then you grew into it?
Mostly,
or?
Well, some of us were
already
feminists, because a lot of women came from women's liberation, and those of us who came from Well, we considered ourselves to be feminists, and we were politically active anyway. But there were others who had not had that experience. I don't know that Louisa or Nikki would have used the feminist word when they first started, but certainly would have over time, and were wonderful, feisty, impressive women, as were there all. I mean, it was a very educational experience being part of WIS. I learned a huge amount from all of them.
That was one of the things I can remember from those early days, is the access to information that was provided. I mean, I used to just wander in off the street and come out with a bag of brochures and information, not even particularly looking for something. It was a great source and a great gathering place.
It was a very welcoming, women-friendly environment, and you could just wander in after your shopping, have a chat to someone, it might start off being very casual, And then gradually, as people felt like they could trust us, they'd open up to a whole range of information. We had this hilarious information system, which I was interested in with my library background, that was a sort of a pink Rolodex on pink cardboard cards.
Some people listening to this wouldn't even know what a Rolodex is.
No, well, it was...
Don't bother explaining,
no,
but that's
right.
It.
But it was really quite hilarious because these pink cards were in this flip availability, and there was no subject headings in those days. There was no organisation. People would put things sometimes under the title of the organisation, but there was no... And sometimes they'd put it under the acronym for the organisation. There was no coherent subject approach, so you couldn't look up women's shelters. If you knew the name of the women's shelters, you might be able to find information about it, but there wasn't necessarily a card saying women's shelters blank blank blank, see all these other places there, or another name like women's refuges, you know, see women's shelters. You know, there wasn't that referral possibility, so finding information in this very eclectic information,
and I can imagine as a librarian
was,
you were horrified.
Well, it was pretty funny, but you know, there wasn't a feminist. There was no feminist type. And Dewey didn't really cut it. You know, it wasn't appropriate to use a proper library system because these were non-librarians who needed to be able to find information in a clear way. So we started off typing up the... They were handwritten, these pink cards, originally, and then gradually we got very efficient at printing them up, and we eventually got a printer that we could, from a computer, we could actually print them up. We thought we were very flash when we could do that. So the information system was, it was a constant battle, and that's where I put a lot of my energy in.
As a volunteer, were you doing
as
that?
As a volunteer, because they knew I had library skills, and I had brought in some other women with library skills who were my friends who'd done my library course. And they came along, and we used to often all collect in one little room and try and work out a sort of system and try and have some coherent headings and try and put cross-referencing things into the Rolodex so we could actually people could find things, because you have to be a bit intuitive as to how people search for information. And we tried to gradually systematise it over time, so it made more sense. And we did, I'm just trying to think back in the early days, there was a volunteer coordinator, but I'm just trying to remember who that person.
That was a paid position.
It was a paid position back then, because later on I became, we had a half-time volunteer coordinator, and this is about, let me think. I went over, I basically worked as a volunteer from 1978 to 1980, I reckon.
Mm-hmm.
And then in 1980, I lived overseas for 3 years, so I stopped being a volunteer.
Where did you go to?
We lived in Bath in the West Country of the UK.
Very pretty.
We had two children and had a lovely time. And I was really miserable until I found a group of socialist feminist women via the columns of Spare Rib.
Oh, I remember Spare Rib.
I made some wonderful friends. Once I found the other feminists in town, I was happy as Larry. Had a great time. So in the end, I probably could have not come back. I had enjoyed myself so much.
So what led you to coming back?
Oh, well, Michael's job had finished. We'd gone for his brilliant career.
What was your husband doing?
He was medical and needed to do some... He'd done a course. The first time we went to the UK, he'd done his membership of the Royal College of Physicians, and we went back for him to sub-specialise in rheumatology. And he was at the Royal Hospital for Rheumatic Diseases in Bath, which is why we were in Bath, because that was all relevant to what he was doing. So then we came back to Adelaide once he finished his qualifications there. So that brought us back, and by 19... So we would have got back about 82, and I became a tutor in librarianship once I sort of got settled, and I got involved on a part-time basis as a volunteer at WIS, just one morning a week, I think. It was, by then I had my children in childcare, well, maybe 2 half-days a week or something, because they were still under school age. And then so I was basically doing some lecturing in library
before we
history.
Move back a little bit to those early years when you were first a volunteer. Was most of the work phone work or drop-ins?
Both. There was a lot of drop-ins, and we spent a lot of time on the radio. Louisa and Nikki ran radio programs in Greek and Italian, so that attracted a lot of women in because they got hear their voices.
Yes, okay.
That attracted them to come in. It was always a bit problematic if they weren't on roster, because the paid staff were on rosters, because we were open 7 days a week, 9 till 9, back in those days.
And could you explain that a bit more? Because for those that know, it's now the Museum of Democracy, where the switchboard used to be. And at night, that can be quite, what's the word I'm looking for, isolated, quite desolate part of the
city.
Well,
we used it back in the beginning. We did. There was usually someone who worked from 9 to 5, and then someone who worked from 1 till 9 was roughly the division of labour. Mm-hmm. And so there was a sort of, in the afternoon when it was sort of likely to be busier, there was a sort of a handover. And there were some volunteers who came after work. But it was quite isolating in some ways. And later on, when I was a paid member of staff and working nights and weekends, I did have one hairy experience on a Sunday, I think. And it was a Sunday afternoon, and obviously it was after 1 o'clock, because on this particular day we'd decided it was very quiet, and the person I was overlapping with had gone home because she wasn't well or something. And so in this afternoon there was no other person there, it was just me. And this man came in and he was saying, "Where's my wife? What's happened to my wife? What have you done with her?" And I couldn't tell him what had happened to his wife or where she was, but I was quite clear that she had rung up earlier in the day and we'd given her information about how to go to the women's shelter and whatever, and it was all... I wasn't able to tell him any of that. So it was quite threatening, because this is about 3 or 4 o'clock in the afternoon.
And in those days, Adelaide was quiet.
And it was quiet. And he was really very cross. "You women, you've hidden her, you've taken her away," and I was there by myself. So I still to this day cannot explain what inspired me. But I just talked really calmly to him and said, that you must be feeling very upset about your situation. And I kept invading his space. And I kept taking a step towards him and another step towards him. And in the end, I backed him. He didn't even know that I was being really calm and really nice and really helpful. And I gradually walked him backwards out the door and said to him, "Farewell, goodbye, I'm sorry I wasn't able to help you, I hope everything turns out for the best," and went back inside and shut all the doors and flipped the lock, because I realised that I was really at risk. But because I managed to talk him down and talk him out. But in those days, we hadn't thought about occupational health and safety.
So what did you do as a result of that? Did you change your procedures at all?
Or I think
how was that addressed for future
incidents? I'm not sure. I'm sure we all had experiences of that kind. Occupational health and safety wasn't in the workplace, really wasn't discussed in those days. I would have told people what happened, and you know, they probably were a bit more careful to try and get somebody to come on the weekends. But, you know, volunteers are volunteers, and, you know, if a volunteer can't come on a Saturday afternoon or a Sunday afternoon because something else is happening in their life, then the paid member of staff was sort of on their own. And there were, and usually after that, we would have the door locked if you were there by yourself. And you would choose to open the door if someone knocked on the door, and you'd make an assessment about whether or not you were going to open the door or leave it locked and say, sorry, it's a telephone service only tonight. There's only, for some reason,
and you, yes,
could, you could always say, you know, you're welcome to ring up, but we haven't got the facilities for anyone to come in.
What were the...
I mean, but you'd use your judgment. And if it was a woman with little children, you'd bring her in.
Sensible,
and if it was a stroppy-looking bloke, then you probably wouldn't invite him in. But they didn't come too often.
Yeah,
the men who rang up and the men who came in were mostly ringing for their mothers, their sisters or their daughters. They knew that they wanted some help for their family members or their girlfriends or whatever. Mostly, in my experience of being at WIS all those years, really didn't... it wasn't a major drama. We didn't have too many difficult men coming in and causing problems. I mean, we could have, but it didn't really happen so much. And really... when the men rang up, they wanted help for their family members mostly.
Oh, that is positive. Was domestic violence one of your biggest issues, if not the biggest?
It was always a huge issue. It still is a huge issue. And
I guess the difference now is that we talk about it.
Yeah, well, we were talking about it then too.
No, I mean, as a society.
Yeah.
But then ordinary people... we didn't know about it, did we?
No, well, a lot of people didn't know about it. But, you know, if you were working at Switchboard, you certainly knew all about it because...
And you would have had training in how to handle
it? There was lots of training, particularly at the very first information camps. And we used to use the Kharkov method.
How do you spell that?
I'm not sure. K-A-R-K-O-F or something, or double F.
Okay, never heard of it.
There was this Kharkov thing where you say, you feel because, and you'd be reflecting back to people, you know, what they said. So you were trying to encourage them to speak and for them to come to the solution rather than you telling them what they should do. So there was always this... very proactive attitude that it was not your job to tell them what they should do. It was your job to give them the options so they could decide what it is that was the best thing, you know, in their circumstances.
So they make the decisions.
And so that they, to empower them to make the decisions so that it wasn't... and that way, I mean, there's a really sensible reason for doing that too. And we used to do that with legal advice at the commission later on in my career, because if they make the decision, then they can't blame you for the consequences. And, you know, that's realistic and practical, and people have to take responsibility for, you know, you can give them information, but it's up to them what they decide to do about it.
What other sort of issues were coming up?
Well, all the issues that are in every women's survival guide.
You've led nicely into that. Liz has brought along a couple of books, two different versions of it, called Every Woman's Survival Guide. Now, when we were talking prior to taping, you were saying you were heavily involved in putting this together. A copy of this will be donated and available to anyone that comes in to listen. But could you talk to me about the book, please, and how it came about?
This book, when I was a paid member of staff, which is after I came back
So when did you start?
It would have been in 84, I reckon.
And how long did you stay as a paid staff member?
84 to 91.
Quite a while.
Well, it was part-time for a long time.
Okay, so that worked well with two young children.
Well, I had no family support, so while my
children... You needed to look after them. Yeah.
While my children were before school, before they went to school, I used to work very part-time or have childcare 2 half-days a week or whatever. So it wasn't until they both went to primary school then I took on this half-time role. Yep. I'd done quite a few different bits and pieces of projects and whatever, but because Switchboard's roster went over nights and weekends, I could fit that in with family childcare. Michael could take responsibility for looking after the children. We could work out his rosters and my rosters so that he could be in charge of the children when I was working. And half-time was manageable. Full-time would have been impossible.
Not with two young children.
Yeah, no. With two young children and no family. And as it was, you know, as soon as one of them got sick, there was always a drama. But, you know, somehow...
That's being a parent, isn't it?
Somehow you managed, that's right. My daughter's quite grateful to me because she said, I don't know how you managed with us when you didn't have the support that you give us now. So... very interesting. Anyway, so I became involved with the Every Women's Survivor Guide. That wasn't how it was started to be called. It started off as a project of the Women's Services Working Party. And this was a collective of women's services that these days, the nomenclature is really about women's services, mostly talks about domestic violence services, because tragically, most women's services have disappeared or been mainstreamed. But in those wonderful days, there were women's health centres all over the city. There was a statewide women's health phone service. And the Working Women's Centre is still hanging on by its tentacles. It's fingernails, probably.
Year-to-year
funding. Every year it's always a struggle about, but in those days they were going great guns. So it was women's health. I'll just have to look at the book for a minute and find out who the other organisations were. Oh, and the Women's Studies Resource Centre.
Of course, yes.
How can I not think of that?
Which was the Feminist Library. Yes, I've visited there many a time. What about from legal services? Did you have...
Were no women's services in those days. Right. There were no women's legal services. It didn't exist. It grew out of Switchboard. We used to have... Part of the reason why I ended up with the Legal Services Commission is I had met all these lawyers on our Saturday afternoon legal services, and that was part of my job was to run the roster for all the lawyers and make sure that lawyers were going to turn up one Saturday afternoon and answer people's questions. And I got to learn a lot about family law and domestic violence and basic legal issues. That helped me later on in my career because I had this bush lawyer training of listening to all these lawyers talking to women about their legal problems. So at that stage, the Women's Legal Service didn't exist. But we knew the issues that are covered in this book. You know, there was housing, health, family stuff, violence in the family, rape, how to get legal advice. We talked about recreation, education, employment, social security, and financial stuff, where to get assistance. And the idea of this book was we actually got some Commonwealth funding. It was a Commonwealth employment program, and I wrote the funding application on behalf of this this women's services network. And it was decided that when we were successful, this little collective, when we were successful in getting this funding, we decided Switchboard was the most sensible place for it to be located because we covered everything and made referrals to everywhere else. And it was the Switchboard bread and butter, really, of all the issues that we used were what's happened, the kind of advice we provided. And the delightful thing about this project is we hired three women, Monica Clements, Helen Ray and Irene Hatsey. They were the clerical officers. And then all the people who were involved in the working party all took responsibility for roughing out what were the most important things for each chapter. It was a very collective process. The people who knew about health worked out what it was that people needed to know about health, and it was all about giving some information about health, but then providing all the very relevant places for people to be referred.
It's an absolutely outstanding reference for all of the organisations that were available to pull that together in one book is a huge task. How long did it take from the idea to getting it done?
I'm not sure. It was a one-year project. We had to do it within a year because we only had funding for a year, and we managed to pull it off at the last minute. We were working right to the deadline. But the lovely thing about it is all the photographs are people who were either volunteers or workers at Switchboard in those years. And
there's some cartoons in there.
And they were all feminist women or friends of Monica Clements or who did the cartoons. It was a real women's activity, I guess.
One of the important things for things like that is, how did you celebrate it?
Well,
worked hard for a year and did it.
A launch, and after the launch, I spent a lot of time on radio and television promoting it. There were these women's programs back in those days, a bit like the Today stuff, I suppose they do now, where I used to have to dress up and go and be charming.
Did you enjoy doing that?
Try and explain why women needed information. Yeah. And it was fun. I did enjoy it. So I ended up being responsible because the project finished. Monica Clements and Helen and Irene, the three paid staff for this little project, their funding finished and that wasn't ongoing. So I ended up with being responsible for future versions of it.
What sort of print run did you do?
Probably whatever was the cheapest, 10,000 or something. And we took it round and we put it in hairdressers and we put it in all sorts of strange places. Women sent copies out to doctors' surgeries to put in their waiting rooms. We tried to distribute it as widely as we could to reach women who would never normally see it, and it was quite an attractive looking.
It's a great publication. You know, it is the sort of thing a woman would think, oh, that looks interesting, I'll pick that up, isn't it?
Yeah, and
it's not at all threatening.
The title, Every Women's Survival Guide, you know, it started off being some South Australian information for women or something. It started off being something really boring, but we came up with that title, and then that was very successful, and then it worked out being a translatable, because later on we managed to get some extra funding, small pockets of funding, basically from the printing. And what we did just for printing more copies, because once we ran out of the original print run, then we had the problem of how are we going to continue it and where we're going to get more money from, because it wasn't part of the core funding of Switchboard to provide a little booklet like this, and I can't remember the details now, but I know we got some one-off funding, and the Greek worker, basically. And by this stage, I think Nikki Dimitropoulos had gone, and Sophia Aslanadis was the Greek worker at the time, and her mother, Koula, was very involved at the Working Women's Centre. So there's Sophia talking to a social work placement student, Jill Marks, at the beginning of one of the chapters. So this book is full of photographs of people who...
People with
links. We all knew who were involved in WIS in some way or other.
So it was translated to Greek, Italian?
So it was Greek. So Sophia, I think, did the Greek. And then later on, Sophie Alexou turned into Sophie Rose. She may have done an edition, may have been involved. We did Greek, Italian, Vietnamese, because by then someone had left and Linh Nguyen Navis was employed to do Vietnamese work with the Vietnamese community, and she used to be on Radio 2, and she translated the Greek, the Vietnamese version. And then we did do a Spanish version. I can't remember who... We didn't ever have a Spanish worker per se, but we did know some people who spoke fluent Spanish, and for some reason they generously donated their time. And
so most of the translations were voluntary translations?
Well, they were done by paid staff members, or this Spanish one, I really can't. I'd have to look at the Spanish translation booklet. It'll tell me who it was, but that name has escaped me. It's a long time ago. But that was, it was great fun doing that and going off and promoting it and publicising it and trying to work out the best way of reaching women across South Australia.
Were you always confident in going out and speaking and doing promotions?
Well, I'd been a teacher.
So it was fairly comfort level for you. With a lot of other women, that's pretty scary.
Yeah, well, I'd been a lecturer at, I'd done some lecturing at university. I'd been a teacher. I was fairly outgoing and confident, and usually I know what I don't know. I never give advice if I don't know something. I say I'm not sure, but I will find out and get back to that person, because I think it's, you can't know everything, but you just need to know where to find out, who to find out from, and then make sure you follow up to provide that information back.
You obviously gave an awful lot of yourself.
I was having a great time.
But what did you get out of it?
I got a huge amount out of it. Working with the Greek workers and Italian, I hadn't had a lot of experience of working in a multicultural organisation. When I was teaching, it was all very WASP orientated, and living in the UK in those days was pretty much the same. So for me, I learnt a huge amount from... about the issues of migrant women in Australia. I learnt a lot. It was interesting because it made me realise that my parents had been most unusual, because when I was living in Albury as a child, my parents were very involved with the Bonegilla migrant camp, and this is when I was tiny, I was a baby, and I've heard more about it since. But it turns out that my parents used to go and collect all the musicians out of the migrant camp and take them home to our house and have them for dinner and play music and play records and got involved in doing all those sorts of things. They also had the Aboriginal tenor, Harold Blair, came to our house when I was a baby, and he was...
I missed the name there. Harold Blair.
He's an Aboriginal tenor back in those days. And it's quite interesting because now I look back and think the things that my parents were doing as sort of socialist / communists back in the 40s, then later on they would have been quite interested in what I got up to in my socialist feminist type activities, I think.
Because a bit of it was in the genes.
Yeah, well, I wasn't really aware of it at the time. But probably the person I learnt the most from at Switchboard was Joanne Wilmot, who is also being interviewed for this project. And Joanne is an amazing woman, feisty as most women at Switchboard were or are, and she really educated me about the situation for Aboriginal people in Australia. And one of her clearest statements to me was, don't ever talk about Aboriginals as a noun. I do not wish to be an adjective. I'm an Aboriginal person or an Aborigine. I am not an Aboriginal because I don't want to be an adjective. I am a noun. I'm a, you know. And that really...
That hit home?
Yeah, it did, yeah. Because I'm... You know, I've got an English history drama background as a teacher, and I've always been interested in the power of words. And for Joanne, was very clear about the situation for Aboriginal people and how badly they've been treated, and that really opened my eyes.
What was her position when you were?
Well, she was the first Aboriginal worker. She would have been there in the 80s when I came back from overseas. We didn't have... It had been recognised that there were very few Aboriginal people coming to WIS. And why would they? It was only when we had Aboriginal workers there, and Joanne was the first of quite a long series of women. It was Margaret Eaton was another Aboriginal worker. There was Dot Casey, and then later Tanya Hosh, who is another amazingly feisty woman who I still have contact with. So I catch up with Joanne every now and then. We have coffee or lunch or whatever, just to...
Lots of friendships have come out of that.
Oh, yes.
And ongoing friendships.
Oh, yes. And But Joanne, I think, educated me more about Aboriginal people than I had experienced anywhere else in my life.
Because as a white woman, you don't have that interaction,
not,
do you?
Not in the country town where I grew up in. And I mean, there were Aboriginal people there, but it was not...
Not part of your life?
Although my parents had a sort of socialist sort of views, they were... My mother had been involved with working with children with disabilities, although they had a terrible title in those days, I think the Retarded Children's Home, because she was a very bright woman who was one of the first in her family to go to university. But because of the war, she had become a teacher and was teaching in Sydney and valued as a teacher during the war. But once the 50s came, it wasn't acceptable for a woman to be in the workplace. And here was this woman, very bright woman, with an interest in astronomy and archaeology and science and geology. And she was at home with four children and pretty bored, I think. So she got involved with the local services and worked the whole time we were in primary school. She was there working as a volunteer. In this home for children with incurable disabilities.
Disabilities. We're very quickly running out of time, and I know you had quite a substantial career afterwards. How was working at WIS influenced what you did later?
Well, I think because I worked at WIS, I met and knew and learnt a lot about Aboriginal people. I met and working with Lynn Quinn Navis and Vietnamese people and whatever, I knew the importance of having specific staff who had training and education, because that would bring those members of the community in, because we could clearly see in the times where there wasn't an Italian worker or there wasn't a Greek worker, then suddenly those people just didn't even bother coming. Or if there wasn't an Aboriginal worker for a month or so, they just didn't come anywhere near. But as soon as you had a designated worker from the Vietnamese community or Spanish or whatever, then in would flow all the people from those different communities, and radio was a great way of reaching them. So I knew when I went to the Legal Services Commission, I used my bush lawyer experience. I was also using my education background, and I ended up running a TAFE course called Law for Community Workers, which was aimed at the sort of people who would have been using Every Woman's Survival Guide as their handbook on where to refer people, how to refer people. And to a large extent, although it was more legally focused, I kept the services. There was always a great impact, I always tried to make sure that people knew where were the specific services that you referred people to for particular areas of law. We didn't ever try and turn people into lawyers. We tried to alert them to what were the legal issues, how to identify a legal issue, and then how to make a good referral that would assist that person to resolve that problem, and to be able to explain the difference between all the different legal options that people have.
And I'm afraid we're going to have to stop there.
Yeah.
I could listen to the rest of your story, which we might do personally some other time. But thank you very much for not just the interview today, but for your massive contribution to WIS, and for the publication like Every Woman's Survival Guide really set WIS up for the sort of service it's now providing. And I think you can be very pleased at the involvement you had in that. So thank you very much, Liz.
That's all right.